Hi, it's Katie.
And I'm Erin.
And we're at El Jardin in Wrigleyville.
And you're listening to Outside the Loop,
Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 966. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. We say hello to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. And happy Easter weekend if you're celebrating. And what a week. You know, I saw this headline and I thought it was really something. Saw this earlier in the week. Could closing Michigan Avenue to cars be the key to revitalizing downtown? Now, if you're on Michigan Avenue, before you clutch your steering wheel and protest, think about this for a second. Downtown office vacancies are pushing 26%. And the loops become less bustling and more of a ghost town with overpriced food and drinks, of course. So city leaders are maybe entertaining the idea of kicking out the cars and turning parts of Michigan Avenue into a pedestrian-friendly promenade. It's just like Paris, except not at all. The idea comes from University of Chicago grad students, and their winning proposal for a competition is entitled Activating the Cultural Mile, and it focuses on transforming a stretch of Michigan Avenue downtown into a pedestrian-focused cultural corridor aimed at boosting economic activity, enhancing safety, and supporting the city's creative community. It's a risk, it's pretty bold, and I kinda like it. So we'll see what happens with that. And meanwhile, over in the Chicago City Council, an environmental justice ordinance meant to finally give black and brown neighborhoods a fighting chance against polluting industry. Yeah, that's been punted to the Rules Committee, also known as the legislative graveyard in the council. It's pretty much like saying we care deeply about clean air, just not right now, just not for you. And so here's the deal. If we've got the guts to rethink one of the most iconic streets in America, surely we can muster the political will to stop treating environmental justice like an afterthought. Chicago can't afford to be a tale of two cities. I've mentioned this before. One where we get greenery and bike lanes, and the other where we get diesel fumes and asphalt playgrounds. So here's a big idea. What if our vision for a revitalized Chicago included everyone? Cleaner air and walkable streets, public space and public health. Economic, cultural, and environmental justice. I think we can do it all. We just have to, you know, work at it a little bit. On the big show today, speaking of the Chicago City Council, what's up with how their staffers are getting paid? We explore that. Also, a local nonprofit organization is providing free counseling for victims of sexual assault on college campuses. And we discover the secret history of the Chicago-based soul and funk band, The Notations. So turn it up, whether you're driving down Michigan Avenue, well, you still can, or not, I'm happy you're here. Chicago has a reputation for not always being forthcoming when it comes to finances and moving money around. And when we're talking about working for those with political clout, sometimes the story even gets more interesting. Alex Nitkin is an investigative reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. That's a nonpartisan investigative journalism organization. His recent article reveals that between October and December of last year, 65 Chicago City Council staffers received salary increases totaling over $260,000 in taxpayer-funded bonuses. While aldermen defend these bonuses as rewards for hard work, critics argue that the process lacks transparency and oversight. Alex is with us here today on Outside the Loop. Alex, nice to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on to talk about this.
You got it. So give us an idea of how this works, because sometimes with government, it's not quite transparent. We don't quite know. So Alder people can give out bonuses to staffers that work for them as they see fit. Is that kind of where all this starts?
Well, the interesting thing is that it all starts with the fact that the answer is no, they technically can't give bonuses to their staffers. And so they have found this kind of runaround loophole to temporarily raise their salaries to effectively give them bonuses. And that's the process that seems to be pretty poorly understood, that we wanted to try to really get to the bottom of what's actually happening here, why has it been happening more frequently, and what might be the alternative to this that might be, I don't know, a little more structured or regular or professional or transparent so it doesn't look shady. And you mentioned that, yes, this is all, there's nothing illegal happening here. There's no violation of any city rules or budget rules, but it's a process that has, I think, degraded a lot of trust in the way that the city council and city spending works. And so we wanted to just sort of illuminate what is going on here.
So let's talk about what is going on here. So you have 50 aldermen in the Chicago City Council, and depending on who they are, they all have some staff members that work for their offices. I know that chair people of committees have more staff members, but you've got these staffers that work for the aldermen, and they say, hey, look, these folks are working hard. They're working 80 hours a week sometimes. So they want to give them bonuses because all the aldermen have like about $309,000 in terms of a budget. So tell us what they're doing here specifically.
I mean, you have all the facts right. And essentially, instead of the way that most city employee positions work is that, you know, you have this position, it makes this salary, that position makes that salary. It's a lot more flexible, is a generous way to put it, on purpose for older people who, instead of saying you get this number of staffers with this salary, you say you have $309,000 to spend on staff over the course of the year as you see fit. Just like you said, if you're a committee chair, you get more staff, which is sort of the real effective perk of having a committee that you're chairing. And so the aldermen get to sort of decide how the money is spent. And what's happening here is that toward the end of the year, alder people are in some cases like realizing, oh, I have this extra money in my account at the end of the year. If it isn't spent, then that money just goes back into the city's general fund, essentially just goes back to taxpayers. But the aldermen are saying, I might as well use this and make sure that I am, you know, spending it on my staff. And you're exactly right that what they said, and I really think they're not wrong about this, look, our staffers are overworked and underpaid. And so if there's any way that we can try to provide one more incentive to keep them from breaking for the private sector, then we might as well do this. The issue and what we've really been trying to bring more attention to is the process by which that's being done, which creates a sort of a smokescreen that gives people the wrong impression of what's happening, and also just doesn't really have any criteria for when a person gets one of these, you know, bonuses or pay increases or why. And so it's a lot of uneven treatment and just pretty arbitrary that, you know, leaves the door open for a lot of potential, you know, favoritism or favors or unseemly things like that.
Right. This is totally up to the aldermen. So whoever holds that seat, they can say, oh, this staffer, I really like this staffer. Maybe I think this staffer is doing a great job, and give that person a bonus, while there might be another staffer or other staffers that don't get the same bonus. So it's really kind of up to the elected official there. This is all kind of on a whim. So, I mean, are there any patterns in terms of which wards or staffers are getting these bonuses, or is this just kind of totally arbitrary?
You know, it's hard to pick out patterns other than the fact that, you know, 2-3 years ago, this was barely even really happening. So we looked back and we pulled a whole bunch of salary data from going back a couple of years. Out of approximately 250, 260 total staffers serving the 50 different city council members, there were 16 staffers in 2022 who got these increases. There were 33 of them in 2023. And as you said, there were 65 in 2024. So patterns among who was doing it. I mean, the more powerful, you know, committee chairs, folks were doing it for their committee staffers. But also one of the biggest payouts that we saw was for someone, people working under Alderman David Moore, who does not have a committee. So the short answer to that question is no, not really. It was older people who were able to just see the opportunity to take advantage of this loophole and provide these temporary pay increases. The question is going to be, you know, is this something that more and more of them have realized that they can do? And next year, or I should say this year in 2025, will they be a little bit more reluctant to use their budget in this way now that it has gotten some attention?
So, yeah, that's one of the things here, that this is lacking transparency. That's one of the criticisms. And some staffers get these bonuses, some don't. There seems to be an increase from year to year over the past few years. So what could happen here is that in the budgeting process, there could be something that is put in there that says, okay, certain city staffers get this percentage of a raise or this bonus structure. Is that the easiest solution to this? Because this is why we're talking about this. This is taxpayer funded, right? This is all taxpayer money. So could we put something in law that says, here's how these staffers should get paid?
I mean, the possibilities are endless. And basically, based on what the council members were saying, they had 1,000 different reasons and explanations for why they're giving this extra money. They're saying, well, they deserve end of year bonuses, or they were paying out of pocket for things that they should be reimbursed for. And the response from one of the folks that we quoted, Joe Ferguson from the Civic Federation, a sort of non-partisan watchdog group, said, okay, well then the city council, they're the ones who get to make the rules for how all of this works, right? So like, if it's a problem that there's no way for staffers to get reimbursed for their own expenses, then make a way for them to get reimbursed and for that to be tracked and entered into the system. If you want to give them automatic cost of living increases, if you want to give them a mechanism to be able to have bonuses and you know, show specific circumstances under which those bonuses are given and make it clear, they're fully empowered to do that. They are the ones who pass the budget. One of the alder people actually who we quoted, Alderman Andre Vasquez, who gave some of these bonuses at the end of the year, and you know, he gave the same reasons, you know, my staff deserve it, they paid out of pocket for things, they're overworked. He gave, I think, a novel solution, which was, hey, the staffers of the city council should really consider unionizing, because then they, you know, like the overwhelming majority of city employees who are unionized, would be able to have collective bargaining discussions over how and when they get compensated and, you know, scheduled pay increases. So that's just maybe one of the more out there ideas, but one of the many, many ways that this whole payment process could be sort of professionalized and brought, you know, above board and in a way that's clear for the public to understand.
And we should understand it because it's public money, it's taxpayer money. We should know how that money is being spent in our city government. And I know that reports like this really help to shine a light on this stuff. So hopefully they take this up, and maybe they will. They'll try to figure out a way to make this more transparent when we talk about aldermen paying their staffers. And Alex Nitkin has the story on this. And we could go to illinoisanswers.org for the Illinois Answers Project. Alex is an investigative reporter at the Illinois Answers Project. That is an investigative journalism organization here in Chicago. Hey, Alex, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for all of this reporting and for keeping an eye on our local government. It's super important.
Thanks so much for having me on to talk about it. I appreciate it.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. It's a time to elevate conversations around supporting survivors and expanding access to healing resources. Dr. Maria Nanos is the CEO of Greenlight Family Services. It's a Chicago-based nonprofit providing 20 free therapy sessions to student survivors of sexual assault across 26 locations on Chicagoland campuses. With a diverse network of 54 trauma-informed clinicians, Greenlight is helping thousands of young people reclaim their sense of safety and healing. And Maria Nanos is here with us on Outside the Loop today. Maria, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So maybe this is the first time that many of us are hearing about Greenlight and what you do. So can you just give us a brief, big picture idea of what you do at Greenlight?
Sure. So Greenlight Family Services has been a nonprofit agency here in Chicago for the last 20 years. We celebrated our 20th last year. And we provide an array of services. One of our biggest programs is the Greenlight Counseling Program, which assists college students who have been sexually assaulted.
And it's that topic that I think is really something here, because according to a Department of Justice report from 2009 to 2019, sexual assault on college campuses increased from 2,500 to 11,800. So do we have any indication of what's happening here? Why are we seeing such an increase?
You know, that's something that we talk about in the community quite a bit. I think that people who experience sexual harm feel a little more confident to come forward. It's not the secret it once was, which is great. With shows like this, Mike, this morning, mm-hmm. I think helped that. And also reporting, I think, is getting a little more sophisticated. So we're hearing about it more, but unfortunately, that doesn't negate the fact that one out of four college freshmen, female, will experience some kind of sexual harm before they graduate college, which is stunning to think about.
Yeah, it really is. And that's an amazing statistic. And, you know, you said that maybe people are a little more comfortable coming forward, talking about surviving sexual assault. But that's one thing that, you know, we've had to deal with in society is the stigma around it. And maybe that's changing a little bit, but we don't want to sort of underestimate the impact that that still has. There still can be a stigma, and it's very difficult for people to come forward when they go through something like this.
It's very difficult. I think many of the students that we have served, which at this point is hundreds, in our programming over the years, have explained the shame that they feel initially. A lot of them seem to get encouragement, believe it or not, from the schools themselves, from their friends, groups they participate in, simply to at least let the school know that something did happen. You know, the next step is for them to engage in therapy if they choose, obviously. But it's very, very difficult for these students to come forward.
You mentioned the schools. When we look more broadly at college campuses and this issue of sexual assault on college campuses, how are schools doing? I mean, we're talking about maybe people are more inclined to come forward if this happens on a college campus, and maybe we're looking for this more often now, but overall, how are college campuses approaching this and dealing with this issue of sexual assault on their campuses?
You know, I will say that it seems over the years, colleges are doing a much better job at acknowledging that these situations happen. They are certainly in a precarious situation, as all of us can imagine. We don't want to be the school. If I were the head of a school, I would probably not want to say to all those college freshmen, you know, one out of four of you will be assaulted, but don't worry, we have services here for you. In addition, we also have to understand that the colleges themselves have therapists who are available to take these students, mm-hmm. but often their clinical staff, they either aren't comfortable treating the more severe cases of sexual assault, and unfortunately, they only offer a handful of sessions for the students. But overall, I think the colleges that we have partnered with are very good at acknowledging that this is occurring, it's a problem, and they will refer out to Greenlight Counseling for support of their students.
Yeah, let's talk about what you're doing at Greenlight. So 20 free sessions of therapy for every student survivor of sexual assault in certain locations here. Tell us about this approach and what you're trying to do.
You know, it's a really simple model, Mike. It's having the students contact us, and then we have partnered with, as you mentioned, approximately 54 therapists across the Chicagoland area. So these are people who have usually a private practice or a group practice, and they have dedicated a slot or two for the survivors of assault. So we pay them a fraction of what they could potentially ask as a fee. And we send the student, we match them based on their area, really, of their locale, where they live or where they're comfortable traveling to. And the therapist then has them in their private practice. So, which is great for these students, because if they were receiving therapy at the school, for example, they potentially could see the alleged offender coming to get a flu shot, for example.
Right.
So this is in the community, in an established therapeutic office, and students aren't seeing you come and go, so to speak. So that's basically the model. The student contacts us, and we match them with a clinician, and the dedicated clinicians give them 5 months of free therapy, and then Greenlight pays the therapist.
That's amazing and just needed. I mean, the importance of counseling, and you know, this is obviously what we're talking about here, is very specific with surviving sexual assault on college campuses, but counseling in general and mental health, I think there's been an improvement in that conversation, but still, I think stigmas are out there about this, but really the importance of counseling for something like this, you can't underestimate that, can't understate it. It's something that can really be transformative for folks who go through this.
Oh, 100%. And I think, you know, students often, at least in my own experience, immediately say, there is no way I'm telling my father, my mother, my brother, sister. I would guess about 7 out of 10 of them come in saying that. And very often, 9 out of 10, at the end of those sessions or beyond, they do talk to their family about the experience. And that's really pivotal for a lot of the students to feel seen, to feel heard, and to continue this growth on into their life. So it is very, very transformative for the students.
Well, you're doing great work at Greenlight Family Services, and the website is greenlightfamilieservices.org. It's really a tremendous approach that you are engaging in here, with this being Sexual Assault Awareness Month, talking more about this issue. It's very important, especially when we think about what happens on college campuses, and you providing 20 free therapy sessions to student survivors of sexual assault is really tremendous. Maria Nanos, the CEO of Greenlight Family Services. Maria, thank you so much for talking to us today, and really keep up the great work, because we need it here.
Yes. Thank you so much, Mike. And for all of your listeners, if you'd like to support a student survivor, we are actually having a fundraiser. Come, go to our events page and take a look, maybe buy a raffle ticket. Every little bit helps, and you can feel really good about helping a survivor.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Super people flying higher than high. Super people, you watch the poor folks die.
Oh my, yes. Once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Mr. Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. He's also a local musician, a music historian, and an artist. And Steve, the world is, I don't know, is it crumbling? Is it on fire? But if it is, hey, we've got some of this pretty sweet soul music, some funk too, from the Notations. That will get us through, right?
It will. I find music to be the ultimate therapy and, you know, positive, again, funky, even, you know, a little Afrocentric soul music is definitely one of the number one things to get me through, you know, dark times and even here, you know, my number one main man is kind of Curtis Mayfield. He was like sort of like this powerful force and wrote these anthems for the people, you know, and he was a big, big force and influence on this group we're about to talk about.
That is correct. The Notations, that's the name of the band from right here in Chicago. And you have the whole story in your column in the Chicago Reader. So Chicago, I mean, and you talk about this a little bit in your column. I mean, just huge contributions to soul music. And you think of like the bands that have come out of here. There's some pretty big ones, some heavy hitters when it comes to soul and funk. The Notations, I mean, just listening to those sweet sounds, they were hanging in there. They could have been something like, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, and As I sort of pointed out, they're still doing it. Whereas, you know, it's the leader, Cliff Curry, you know, sort of keeping the name alive. And, you know, and a lot of these reunions are that. But he's the leader, and he has been since the 60s. And then you look at some of these other bands that are sort of like, oh, Earth, Wind & Fire reunion. Oh, boy, there is nobody in that band I know anymore. And then, you know, or you know, the Chai Lights still play sometimes a little bit. But as far as doing the old songs led by the original dude, the Notations are kind of like, they're kind of in a class by themselves.
Yeah, they are. So you mentioned founding member Cliff Curry. He's been doing this now for more than 60 years, which is just amazing. So tell us how this whole band starts. Cliff Curry, born in March of 1946. He grows up on the South Side. How does this all start?
Yeah, well, first I got to say, Cliff is like an amazing dude, a ball of energy at his age, and just like enthusiastic, you know, like I could hardly keep up with him interviewing him. And yeah, he's just like full force. He's doing videos, he's publicizing his stuff. He's just an amazing guy. And you know, from luckily, thanks to Aaron Cohen, who wrote a great book on Chicago soul, Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, he connected me to Cliff. So thanks to him, and a cool book everyone should check out interested in this music. But yeah, he grew up in Inglewood, and his mom sang, played piano in a gospel group. So it's just like there were always, I guess from what I read, just musicians coming and going from his house like all the time. So he was just exposed to it at a very early age, you know, and just met other kids in his neighborhood who, you know, were into the same thing. And, you know, the big one was this cat, LaSalle Matthews, who ended up being his collaborator forever. And, you know, they started singing like harmonies together.
Yeah, and they sound so good. And so these guys are in high school, Paul Robeson High School. Back then it was Parker High School. And it's one of these where they win the big prize in the school's talent show. And they meet some other musicians at a very young age that ultimately will be collaborating together down the road.
So, yeah, they started using the Notations name like about 1962. You know, like a lot of bands, they started on a tiny label that, you know, people don't even seem to remember too much about, called Tad Records. I guess it burned to the ground and like all records were sort of lost, literally records and the records of the records were lost. But so they kind of started on a, you know, smaller label there, still kind of starting to pick up members. They got this guitar player, Brad Bobo, who was like pretty essential, and sort of assembled like a proper musical group, you know, to back the vocalist, called the Soul Creators. And, you know, then they start out gigging out once they're all out of high school, basically. You know, they started gigging out, it sounds like, right away. And then they caught the attention of not someone maybe everyone will know, but was kind of a big deal also in the local soul scene and nationally, later Syl Johnson.
So the Notations, tell us about the song here, I'm Still Here, because this is kind of like the big song, maybe their best song. It got some local radio play. It even got on the Billboard R&B charts.
So that was actually the first single they did for Twinight, and it was a pretty darn big hit, and it's amazing. You hear it, it's got this amazing guitar part from Bobo, and like, I guess sort of last minute, they got Curry to do this sort of vocal. They were like, you do the vocal. I don't like what Matthews is doing. And he was like, oh, okay. And he did this sort of jokey, yelpy thing with the vocal that Syl was like, there you go, that's it. And he was like, wait, what? You know, that really wasn't my take. And he's like, it was, that's the song. Recorded it, became a huge hit. You know, it locally almost went to like number one, and then nationally it went to you know, like 30 something on the Billboard R&B charts. So he accepted it. He accepted that this was going to be the vocal, you know, for this and everything. And that was going to be just sort of the signature thing of the song and everything. But yeah, really, really cool song, and definitely beloved among overseas, among this sort of like Northern Soul crowd and all this as well. But baby, if I wasn't, can I take back what I say?
The Notations, they go on, they cut more songs, and they are touring. So what ends up happening? I know like there's music involved in there, like 70s and the 80s, and then eventually they're going to reform in the 90s, and they're kind of, I mean, they're doing it again. I know that in your column, there's like a video, it's like a real music video with some of these guys, and there's like women on cars and stuff. What happens to the Notations here coming into, you know, contemporary times?
Well, it's, you know, there was only just like a short break. You know, they went to this label that Curtis had a hand in called Gamigo in the 70s. And, you know, those did okay. And pretty much after that, they even jumped to Mercury, big label for a second, but that didn't really work out for them. So they kind of took a pause in about 1977 or so. And then they sort of came back in the 90s. People started sampling them. People started these sort of cool B-sides. They did this song called Super People that was supposed to go to Curtis, actually, that was on this label. And all of a sudden, these DJs are playing it because they realize it's this really cool, funky track. So they're back, you know, they're back. And, you know, we didn't go into it, but there were a number of lineup shifts and backing bands before. So basically just took Cliff, you know, to sort of pilot the ship again. And they found a label, you know, that is, it's actually based in Sherman Oaks, California. And it's like it seems like it's like a Latin owned soul label, and they're total purists, you know, for this kind of music. I think it's called Sleeping Giant, I think was the name of the label. And, you know, provide the backing and do everything. And you know, some of them are redos of old songs and some are new songs. And I got to say, they're pretty good. I'm really hard on, like, you know, sort of legacy artists, new material. I always hear it and I'm like, oh, man, you know, like this they're not doing what made them good. They're trying to modernize for sort of like, you know, in a way that doesn't work for them. And, you know, that, you know, we've all heard it. And they're just still doing smooth harmonies. And yeah, you know, like you said, maybe they're in a lowrider truck and they got some gals hopping around too. But the songs are great. You know, I was really impressed, actually. And the harmonies are just, like, you know, still gorgeous, you know?
So great. The Notations are also performing on Saturday, July 12th at Morgan Park High School. So they're still doing it. They're still performing. We can go see the Notations.
You can still see them. And my editor, Philip, noted how rare that is in Secret History that we can list, hey, this artist is playing. You can go see them in a couple months. So that's a rare thing. So, yeah, all the details are listed in the column. And I'm definitely going. I feel like this is a rare opportunity, and to see them in a, you know, like a sort of high school auditorium where they grew up. It just seems like definitely got to check it out.
The Notations, there you go. The full story is in the Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He's also a local musician, music historian, and artist. And Steve, thank you so much for talking to us today, bringing us the story of Chicago's very own The Notations. Some sweet, sweet soul funky music for us.
And you know they had to be good, because Cliff told me a story of them opening for James Brown, and James Brown told them they had to tone it down.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 966 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his wonderful engineering help in the WGN Radio studio. If you're celebrating Easter, have a wonderful Easter. Have a great week. And I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.